All right, we're in Genesis 34 and 35 tonight, and I will go ahead and read, let's see, I don't know, suppose we could just go ahead and just treat the whole thing. So I'll read 34 and 35, and then we can make comments, okay? Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Remember, they had come to Shechem from Succoth, right? And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay her and violated her, which is actually a very bad word for this. It really wasn't very likely it wasn't a violation specifically, but his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young woman as a wife." And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah his daughter. Now his sons were with livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field, and they heard it. And the men were grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us. Give us your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourselves in it." Then Shechem said to her father and to her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask whatever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as a wife." But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, and spoke deceitfully because they had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition, we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we'll become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone." And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of the city and spoke to the men of the city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Therefore, let us dwell in the land and trade in it. For indeed, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us is circumcised as they are. Will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us." And all who went out of the gate of his city, indeed Hamor and Shechem his son, every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Now it came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of the sons of Jacob, namely Simon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, and their donkeys, and what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives they took captive, and the plunder even of all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me, and I shall be destroyed, my household and I." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" Then God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother. And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods who are among you, purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and all earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the timber tree that was in Shechem. And they sojourned, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So Jacob came to Luz, that is, Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the timbrent trees. So the name of the place, name of it, was called Elon Bakuth. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. Also God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac I give to you, and to your descendants after you I give this land." Then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. Then Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke to him, Bethel. Then they journeyed from Bethel and went there, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel travailed in childbirth, and she had hard labor. Now it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have a son also." And so it was, when her soul was departing, for she did die, that she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father changed his name to Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, to Bethlehem, or what would become Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this very day. Then Israel joined and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eber. And it happened, when Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12, and the sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah were Rachel's maidservant were Dan and Naphtali. And the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. Then Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. So Isaac breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. So those are the two chapters. And as usual, I'll give you guys a chance to go ahead and start making your observations and insights known first.
Another example of dysfunctional family.
Yeah, very, very dysfunctional. No question. Yes. Yes.
One thing I noticed in the very beginning of 33, it's 33, somewhere where it tells his family to pack up and go up to Bethel.
Mm-hmm.
And then verse 15, it says Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him Bethel.
Mm-hmm.
So it was named. Maybe I misread that God spoke with him at the beginning.
No. God did speak to him at the beginning.
He mm-hmm. did.
Yes, he did. Absolutely.
So he knew what he was gonna. In other words, it was called that
Before yes,
he went there. Mm-hmm. And then yes. he called it back.
Yes, as to whether or not this is a second occurrence of the exact same thing or a repeat of it is uncertain. Because it appears to be the same place. And what we read in the former place when he said, though, after he had that vision and God spoke to him, is very much the same as what's said here. It's almost a carbon copy. So I wondered that myself, whether or not, because in the Hebrew they have a tendency to sometimes repeat information that has already been said and interject it where it might become pertinent, because he was coming back to the place where God had already done these things. So it's possible they're repeating what had been done before, just for our, you know, edification or whatever. So, but one way or the other, this may be a repeat, it may not be. So, but the offering of the offerings, both on the altar and the oil and the wine, was something that was being done this time for the first time. That had not been done up to this point, as far as we know.
When they talk about pouring a drink offering, is mm-hmm. that... do they actually drink it?
No. They pour it out upon an altar or upon a pillar or a pile of stones symbolically. It's offering it to the Lord. They don't actually drink it themselves. No.
Hold on.
What, Terry?
With Bethel, in variations, of course, it's just a house of God. So it could be that he did call other places that, even though there was one main place called that.
It's possible. It's unlikely, but it's possible, because usually they were careful to name things very specifically. And if Jacob had already called one place Bethel, he probably would not have been careless and called yet another place by the same name. But I can't rule that out as an impossibility.
Well, he said whenever he left Laban that he was going to return.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So, which is the place where God spoke to him when he's the rock with his pillow when he saw the... So yeah, it's that's where he came back to. It seems apparent to me this was in fulfillment of what God told him. I want you to go back to Bethel. So
well,
that's where he was.
Like around here, you can look up a mountain to find the word Bayshore Road. Mm-hmm. Many different places, and it can be confusing.
Yeah, it can be. You're right.
If you're looking for New York City, you're only going to go to one.
You're only going to go to one place. That's right. That's true. So and you had something also, Virginia.
The other one I forgot, but I was going to continue with what Doris said about the dysfunctional family.
Mm-hmm.
But I know probably at that time, in their culture, it wasn't a family thing where they gathered the family, let's sit down, let's talk, let's do this, or, you know, to the father taking the children under his wings, even as little, mm-hmm. and teaching them. I'm sure his father Isaac didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's isolated himself away from, again, it's protecting. And you see him, you know, after the two boys go mm-hmm. in and slaughter everybody, you know, what have you done?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to have the neighbors kill me. Mm-hmm.
He's got an ongoing problem with fear over his own safety.
Self.
There's
yeah.
no question about that.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've seen it multiple times already, and this is yet another example of it.
Well, and it's another way of hiding. That's why, you know, he's not connecting with his children at all. I feel so bad for the young boys growing up and the strife and this turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no guidance from the father.
There doesn't appear to be. Of course, we only have part of the story. We don't actually know what their relationship would like. But, yeah, I definitely don't get the impression that he was exactly the best mentor as a dad. I certainly don't walk away with that impression. These boys were unruly. And as I will bring up later on, they just run roughshod right over their father. Jacob does not have the ruling of his house. There's no question about it. And that's a bad thing. There's a lot of things evidently that God saw that were right about Jacob. I think it would be a real far stretch to say that he was a great dad. And I don't think that he had the rule of his house. If he did, then this right here is just a weird example that's not the norm. But because we have so few examples of him leading in his family, when the only example you have is him not stepping to the plate, it leaves you with a certain impression. So, especially in something like this, you would have thought that he would step to the plate, and he said nothing. He let his boys speak for him. And that's not right. He should have taken the lead.
Well, yes. Even in the past, when you talked about Rachel going back and getting the idols from her father's house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He didn't step in. So you're going to have dysfunction there because you've got Jacob at the time, so looking toward God and said, God has blessed me, God has done, giving honor to God and acknowledging. And yet with Rachel and Leah, they grew up in the same household, so they're both going to be looking at those idols. So there's going to be that influence in the lives of the children.
Yeah.
And no wonder Dinah's going out to see what the other ladies are going on, because they're in a pagan area.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're right.
Do we have anything in common? I'm going to go check it out.
Mm-hmm. that idol curiosity will get you every time.
Yeah, why was she going there all alone?
She shouldn't have been.
That's
common sense. Should have told any young girl, don't go into a city.
Well, she denied her father and mother at that point either.
Yeah, but there again, we also have to ask the question. Same question any of us would ask whenever you hear that such and such happened to a child. You're like, where the heck was their parents? Where's their parents?
Huh.
You know? And, she's got what amounts to, four mothers, and one dad. Surely, and she's the only girl, you would think that they would be watching out for this girl. Where the heck is she? So, now we don't know. She might have had their parents' permission, in which case Jacob and the family were just stupid. Or she may have slipped out without asking. We're not told. But one way or the other, the action was stupid. Whether it was a stupid request and they granted it, or it was a stupid unilateral decision where she snuck out, it was a stupid decision. And, it's not surprising at all that what happened. So, God intended the father to be a covering. But, that requires two parties. The father needs to be aware of what's going on, and the daughter needs to be willing to be covered, instead of running out on their own. So, yeah, that's a real problem.
Well, but it also doesn't really say whether she was a willing participant.
No, but it's very...
or not.
No, it doesn't. It implies that she most certainly was. But even if she wasn't, it doesn't make any difference. She chose to go out into that city as a 13 to 15-year-old girl without any supervision. That was a dumb decision. It was very irresponsible.
Great.
Yeah. And so whether it was rape or whether it was by consent, she wouldn't have been in that position if she'd stayed home.
Well, obviously her family believes it was the latter.
No, that's not necessarily true. And the reason why is because to them, coming from Israel, number one, and coming from their background, it would have been inappropriate for them to have relations without being married. And so that alone was considered to take advantage of her. In the same way as if in today's world, it's no different. You have a guy and a girl and they go out and the girl gets pregnant. 9 times out of 10, who's going to be blamed for that? The boy is. I'm not saying the girl's going to be held completely blameless, but most of the time it's going to be, well, he was aggressive and she didn't want to say no, and... and I guarantee the father of that girl's going to say, that boy pushed himself on my girl. That's always going to be their view, regardless of whether it was the truth or not.
That I've heard.
Well, even if if it was consensual, if she was under, like today, if she was consensual and she was underage.
Mm-hmm. Well, she wasn't underage at that time.
Yeah,
a woman was able to be married easily by the age of 12 or earlier.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And biblically speaking, just to go a step further with that, the Bible doesn't really give you a whole lot to go on. In the book of Ecclesiastes, I think it is, and another place also, it says that a girl should be beyond the flower of her age, which means she has started ovulating. But after that, it doesn't say anything about it, positive or negative, as to whether or not she could marry. But if it was before then, that's not okay. Biblically speaking, but of course, biblical hadn't been written yet. So, and who knows what the morals of Shechem was? Who knows? It would be anybody's guess.
What makes them think if these guys become circumcised that it's going to be okie dokie?
I don't know. That's a very good question. There's two possibilities. One is that they may have made an implication because of what Shechem and his father had said to them was that we will become one people. Well, if they are taking them based on their word, they could have thought, well, there's no way we can become one house if you guys aren't circumcised, because anybody who's part of the house of Abraham, if they're a male or if they're brought in as a servant and they're a male in this house, they must be circumcised. And so you can't have our sister unless you're circumcised. So that's one way. And so it may be that what they said was true, but they said it deliberately to deceive them because they're going to take advantage of the situation. Or it's also possible, equally possible, that they didn't think that was true and they just said the whole thing just to deceive them. So I'm not sure. Because we'd have to know what was going on in their head and how they interpreted what God had said to Abraham. And we don't really know that. But if you were, and I thought the same thing. And I went back to, I think it's in chapter 17, I think it is, where God brings up circumcision initially to Abram. And he talks about everybody that is in your house. And so from their perspective, is it possible that they thought if we join these two people and we become one people, that also equates to one house? It's possible. So that may be one. It could just be also that they were just seeking to deceive them, period.
So, it definitely says in witnesses, he spoke to them deceitfully.
Yeah, there's no question. Yeah, so, but that doesn't mean that what they said was wrong, but their intention in saying it was to deceive them.
Well,
it could be the one.
Again, I think part of it, too, is it's a partial truth.
Of course, yeah, that's our ongoing problem. Yeah.
But even within their house, if there had been a son born, that for whatever reason decided to not be circumcised and rebel, they couldn't have allowed her to marry him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was true that she could not marry an uncircumcised person. That was a true statement. What they left out was that you also have to be part of her lineage.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, possibly.
Is there anywhere in the scriptures, I mean, that we're looking for, but I don't know, so I'm asking, where it says that Dinah gave birth?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of.
So there's maybe they could, well, if this is the case, then we're going to, you know, try and rectify restore honor to our daughter, our sister by making us as one family.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly all of these events happened relatively quickly right after one another. So even if she had become pregnant, no one would have known. So because these events were very clearly back to back.
Yeah, because they left there.
Exactly, yeah. And Jacob was still afraid that they might be pursued.
I didn't know if there's some place in the Bible.
I don't know. I'm afraid I don't know. But I'm not aware of it one way or the other. Yes, Emma?
I think maybe in their society too, she got hurt twice because she would have probably not been married after that.
Mm-hmm. Possibly.
Possibly not be married because she was defiled now. And they robbed her of a husband.
Mm-hmm.
Someone that she could have loved.
Yeah. And again, we really don't know.
Yeah.
Because, the law wasn't there.
Right.
And if the law had been there, she would have been free to remarry because her husband was dead. Or the guy that could have been her husband was dead. So she still would have been free, even by the law, to remarry or to marry. But I don't know what, you know, again, like we said, and this is what is interesting about this time period is there is no law yet.
Yeah.
So whatever is their custom, and God only knows, literally, God only knows what these guys' customs were because, you know, Abram was taken out of Ur of the Chaldees, and we really don't know what their customs were. He wandered for a long time, and then, so they probably picked up some things along the way. So, and if God didn't tell them, this is what you will do, they probably just kind of rolled with the punches and thought if they were in the areas of the Philistines, they saw the law and they thought, hey, that's a good idea. We're going to start doing that. You know, I mean, so who knows what they thought. So,
referred to Shechem as being a prince, so therefore his father was a king.
Yes.
So when they went back and they gave the people this information, given by Simeon and Levi, all those men are honoring the king's request.
Oh, yeah.
Because
He's king.
He's king. Not yeah. because of what they're going to get from it themselves. Yeah, I mean, that would be part of the package.
Yeah, I mean, there seemed to be some type of leverage going on trying to convince him it was the right thing. So who knows? I mean, kind of like in Persia, they had laws that even bound the king. And so it's possible that the king, maybe they had a type of cabinet and House of Representatives kind of thing going on, because these were at the gate, and traditionally back then the men that were at the gate were the judges of the city. And so it's possible the king, in order to make or could not have imposed it, he may have had to present it to them and then take a vote. So I don't know, but it's possible. Now, obviously, almost in any society, the king is going to carry a lot of authority. That's safe to say. So any other thoughts? Yes.
I know we discussed this earlier, but the two other things that would lead me to believe that it might have been consensual is, of course, her being over there. She obviously had a desire to be around those people, so she probably had already seen his advances from afar, so to speak, in one way or another. She was hanging out over there. But because... unless they were holding her captive, she was in Shechem's home.
Mm-hmm.
You would think if she was defiled, if she was able to, she would have run home.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And then home.
And there's nothing there that says that she was detained by him.
Right.
So in fact,
you know,
it says that he spoke kindly to her.
You wonder if she wasn't hanging out there hoping they would say, yes, you can marry him.
Yeah. So.
And the other thing is the fact that it talks about his longing for her. It wasn't just an overnight, one-night stand thing for him. It was he meant business with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, makes mention that he was an upright man.
He was honorable, is what it says. He was more honorable than anybody in his father's household. All leads you to believe this probably was not a date rape. Doesn't mean it wasn't possible. But even if you go back and you look up the words that all point back to what actually happened, none of them gridlock it into that. And all that follows doesn't make it sound that way. If he had forced himself upon her, like if you read in some translation, it says that he grabbed her. Well, the word grab is a terrible word. If you look it up in the Hebrew, it doesn't even mean grab. So you have to be real careful and look up the words and see what's actually being said here in the Hebrew. In fact, there's a lot of people that know more about Hebrew in a minute than I know all day that translate that as he seduced her, which would indicate that she gave in willingly. So, and that's not that hard to figure out. I mean, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that a young impressionable girl was wowed by power and a guy that was showing advances towards her.
Well, she was the only girl with 12 brothers.
Exactly,
She's going to be curious.
Of course she is. Yeah, absolutely. And she clearly wanted to know. Didn't say she scoped out the land to find a guy. She was scoping out the land to check out the chicks to find out. And the only thing that you can get out of that is from what I can see in looking up the words, was essentially that it was idle curiosity. What do the women in this city wear? What do they like to listen to? What do they do? It was just a matter of how can I fit in?
A new friend.
Yeah, and so she just kind of went in there to find out, you know. There are actually at least one commentator, if not two, that insinuated that based on the words of going into the city to, what was the exact wording again? Verse chapter.
Went out to see.
Went out to see the daughters of the land. They insinuate that it's possible based on that wording that there may have been some gathering of the women, like what we might have called today a ball or something like that, something where they were gathered. And she wanted to come and be like among them. So one way or the other, curiosity killed the cat. It's never a wise decision to do something like this. This was a very bad decision.
Well, she's been surrounded by all these men. No wonder she wanted to go find out what the ladies are doing.
Yeah. Well, and probably the only... and the only women she was around were probably constantly in a cat fight, you know. So, you know, so, yeah. I mean, no one can blame the girl for wanting to get some air. But this was One way or the other, it was without question a very poor decision.
But Mark, that Shechem was an honorable man, and that's
Well, more honorable than his father.
More honorable than him. Yeah. Had he really been wanting to honor her, he would have gone and said to him, I'd like to have her to be my wife before he even...
Well, it's possible. Again, it depends on what their culture is. You know, I mean, not having the impress of the Holy Spirit, not having the Word of God to them, they may have thought nothing of having sex outside of marriage. So, I mean, it's so hard to say, you know what I mean? Because we just don't know what they were thinking and what was common in their day. Clearly, marriage was an issue because he wanted to marry her. And I would agree with you based on our morality and what we know is right, without question. Without question. The fact is that as a king, he could have just rose the men up and said, hey, I want you to fight for me because I'm taking this chick, whether his family wants it or not. But instead, he humbles himself, and he doesn't even send somebody else. He goes himself with his father and asks for her hand. Now, granted, you and I understand, well, you know, you've already had her in bud, you know, so we're looking at it from another vantage point, but the point is, he didn't have to do that, and he's willing to give whatever you want. You know what I mean? So, again, and when he was told what he needed to do, he didn't hesitate. So clearly his heart was towards this woman. And after the event, if she had been angry because she had been violated, you would expect that the words would have said he tried to comfort her, but instead it just says that he spoke kindly to her, which is different. You know what I'm saying? Because if a woman's angry, speaking kindly is not going to do a lot. You know what I mean? You do your best to calm her down or try to comfort her or something. But speaking kindly, I don't think that he could be that. He might be that dumb. I don't know. But I again, there's just all the different angles don't lead up to that. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. I'm just saying it's unlikely. So let me start at the beginning of chapter 34. Of course, with all this discussion, some of this is going to be repeat. But Dinah was probably between 13 and 15 at the time. We know that because of certain events that had gone on. And when she was born in order, she couldn't have been older than 15. And she almost certainly could not have been younger than 13. So she was in that bracket. Old enough to know better and still naive enough to not care. And had attained, so she had attained maturity. For this is often the case in the East, that after the age of 12, and sometimes earlier, woman can engage in sexual intercourse. This means that she was young and impressionable. She went alone, which of course was foolish, whether it was because she was allowed to or whether she snuck out. One way or the other, it's clear by the wording here that it was simply out of curiosity. Shechem, the prince of the country, took her and lay with her. It would seem not so much necessarily by force as the wording there, it actually when it says took, it means by surprise. It was not so much by force. Something that caught her off guard, like the affections of a king. That would catch a girl off guard, I would imagine, you know. Note, great men think that they can do anything. And that's true. You know, so I'm not saying that it's beyond the morality of what we know of Shechem that he couldn't have done something forcing himself on her. One way or the other, from our perspective, none of it was honorable. But whether the question is whether it was just dishonorable for her, I mean for him, or for him and her, we don't know, right? But one way or the other, we know how the dad and the boys interpreted it. One way or the other. You know, this is... Now, I mean... I understand Shechem's household is going to see it in Shechem's favor, but this household is going to see it in the girl's favor. Shechem was the prince of the... Okay, I said that. The fact that the passage tells us that he spoke kindly to her, sought the favor and permission of her father to marry, was willing to be circumcised, and was said to be more honorable than all of his father's house would lead us to believe that this was probably seduction. It is not uncommon for a young girl to get swept off her feet by the advances of a young man, especially one who is famous or powerful or whose affections might make her the envy of other women. She came to... let's see. She and her parents had the word of the Lord on issues like that. Okay. Obviously, the word of God had not been written up to this point, but had Titus 2:5 been written, she might have been better prepared for this, because it tells us that young women must learn to be chaste and keepers at home. Of course, the law of God was not there yet. But that would have probably kept her at home instead of meandering out into a city all by herself. We need to be careful what curiosities we wind up indulging. Jacob was silent. He let his impetuous sons speak for him. When Shechem and his father came to speak to Jacob, he first found out about it, and it says he held his peace. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. He was waiting for the boys to come in, and that's not necessarily bad. But he continued to hold his peace, by all accounts, and allowed his sons to speak up, and not only speak up and give their opinion, but give the final word of what was going to happen, without ever speaking anything himself. This is not Jacob taking the lead in his family. This is allowing himself to be run over roughshod. And it was not the way a godly man should operate. Jacob should have declined immediately, or out of respect to the covenant, or at very least sent them away to give them time to discuss it with God and his sons. At very least. You know, I can't give you a decision right now. I haven't even spoken to my God about this, right? Or let me at least take counsel with my boys and we'll get back to you. But none of this happened. He just let the boys blurt out, and he didn't tell them to hold their peace. This was a very, very bad decision on Jacob's part. The passage says that Jacob's sons answered, but we later see that in fact it was Simon and Levi seemed to have been the one that acted alone in this council. It was these two who particularly targeted Shechem and his father, and who carried away Dinah back to their father's house. And somehow these two boys were able to destroy all of the men. It doesn't say that the other boys came with them. They only came after everybody was dead. It doesn't look like anybody was really in on the lie but these two boys. Are you following? So that also tells us a lot. Now, it's impossible to, it is possible that, like I said earlier, that what they said concerning you can't marry her unless you're circumcised or whatever might be true, or maybe they just thought it to be true, but their purposes in saying it, one way or the other, was to deceive them. Jacob clearly regretted his silence and temporary agreement with their words, which he was, which he, as a standbyer, took for counsel. This is clear based on two things that happened later. Number one, of course, he said, "You guys have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I'll be destroyed and my whole household will be destroyed." And this, we see Jacob's ongoing fear of safety. At least if this passage gives us all the information we need to go on, Jacob never one time consulted God, nor did he even ask him for protection and faith. You don't see it anywhere. All you see is fear. Right?
Yeah.
That's all you see. Now, again, we're not saying he didn't. I'm just saying it doesn't bring it up. Right? All we see is, he wasn't even so concerned about the fact that they did wholesale slaughter of an entire city as much as he was concerned about the implications on him. Oh, yeah, and my household. He brought himself up twice, his household once.
Or that they knowingly, from the beginning, were deceived.
Were deceptive.
But these two people that were trusting him went back and said, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
These are good people.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done
that
two
of them. We're not so good people, yes. Also, if you were to skip ahead, which I'm not going to have you turn there, but you might make note of it. We are going to run into it eventually. But in Genesis 49, verse 5 through 7, you see more about what was in the mind of Jacob about these two sons, because the prophecies that he gave over his boys at the end of his life, he included Simon and Levi in the exact same prophecy. He prophesied over all the rest of them individually, but those two he coupled together. Okay, and this is what he said. It was in, it's in Genesis 49, verse 5 through 7. It says, Simon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter into their counsel. Why would he say that? Because he did enter into that council once before, right? Let not my honor be united to their assembly, which it was once before, right? For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Now, in other translations, it says they dug under a wall. Those sound like radically different translations to you and I in the English. Let me help explain. One of the reasons for that is the Hebrew language is based upon symbols, or initially. And each symbol and each stroke of the pen represents something. Some of them represent animals, like oxes. Some of them, if you chain them together, can represent a wall, or could represent authority, or could represent a king or a prince. And so in this particular case, more than likely, what this was, because prophecy often comes in the form of poetry, this was probably a form of parallelism, where you say the exact same thing, one after the other, in its exact same statement said differently, and you kind of add something to it. And that's probably what was being done here. He says, for in their anger, they slew a man. And in their self-will, they hamstrung an ox. Now, by hamstringing, what that means is kind of like what they used to do to horses, unfortunately, and cut that tendon in their thigh to keep them from being able to run. And, of course, what had happened to the prince was he had been circumcised and he wasn't able to defend himself. And as an ox, there was a representation of royalty. So, in poetic words, they were saying that you hamstrung an ox. You made it impossible for the king to flee, right? So in their anger, he says, you killed a man, and in their self-will, they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is indeed fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That was his prophecy over these two boys, and he put them both together. So we already know what Jacob thought, right? And it's interesting that one of the two was going to be the line through which God ministered to Israel, was the Levites, right? They were definitely separated from the rest of Israel, weren't they? But so was Simeon. Yeah, Simon. Or Simeon, however you want to say it. But also, you know, it's possible, just possible, that what here was displayed as an act of self-will was based out of a character trait that at its core God could use. And that was a need for justice. That would serve the Levites well in the wilderness, watching over the word, watching over the administration of the word, watching over the sacrifices. That would serve them well. But anything, even if it's a godly trait, if it is expressed solely and entirely through the flesh, becomes evil to its core and taken to extremes. You know, if they had really been interested in justice, they would have just killed the young man. Because the father wasn't even involved in the initial act, was he? But they deliberately killed an entire company of men for the act of one. They weren't seeking justice, they were just angry. Right? So justice wasn't what was really on these people's minds. They were just looking to vent anger, right? And that didn't settle well with Jacob. In the end, Simon and Levi were unrepentant and defended their action to their father as if they were somehow noble in doing what they did. Should he treat our sister like a harlot? Well, certainly not. The answer is to that, certainly not. But at the same time, does that give you the license to just wholesale slaughter a city? Well, no. The two crimes aren't even equal. You know what I mean? So Jacob's disobedience to return home cost both he and this entire kingdom of Shechem. Because God, remember, originally told him, I want you to go back to your house, back to Bethel. But instead he went to Succoth and he stayed there for a while. And then he moved on to Shechem and stayed there for a while. And what was the result of their, if not disobedience, their lagging obedience was an entire city was slain. because of his disobedience. Disobedience has high costs, and rarely, rarely does it cost the person who committed the crime as much as it causes collateral damage to others. It's true. You can't sin unto yourself. It's impossible. And more than not, it's going to cost more people, other people, more than it costs you in your sinning. And that's okay, because there is equality, because their sins can affect you more than it affected them. It's all going to get around, right? But, you know, I just wanted to point out to you that none of this would have happened if he'd just been quick to obey. Dinah could have never gotten mischievous, never gotten in trouble, whether she was raped or whether she allowed herself to be seduced. The whole thing couldn't have happened. And the brothers could not have been enticed into something that would have caused them to bear reproach and a prophecy spoken of them that was negative for the rest of they and their descendants' lives if their father had just been obedient. So lots of people pay, don't they? So now chapter 35. Any other thoughts from chapter 34?
On chapter, go ahead to chapter 35. You see why, if he had gone, you see the results of what would have been a blessing.
Oh, yeah.
That he missed.
That he missed entirely. Delayed, or at least initially missed, yes.
Yeah, and, well, he delayed the blessings because yes. He delayed.
Yes, exactly. He delayed what could have happened much sooner and sidestepped something that could have never happened. So in chapter 35, God again comes to Jacob and tells him to go towards his home. And he says, "Dwell where I met you. Dwell where I met you as I met you where I did when you were fleeing from Esau at the beginning." Similar to what he told him in Genesis 31, "Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers, to your family, and I will be with you." Jacob makes mention of God having protected him in the past, which reveals what was, at least in part, at the root of his desire to become obedient this time. Up to this point, he wasn't in a big hurry to go home and be obedient to God. Now that his sons have slain an entire city and he's afraid for his life, he calls to mind that, well, you know, God told me I should probably go home. And this is the same guy that protected me from my brother Esau. Why don't we go home? I think he's thinking about his own protection. And does God honor it? Yeah. He causes the fear of himself. God causes his fear to fall on all the surrounding nations so that they do not pursue Jacob and his sons, right? But I don't think that Jacob's obedience was purely out of good motives. I think it was because he was scared for his life, and he wasn't exactly sure if God was going to go through for him this time, but I guarantee he's probably not if I'm not obedient, so I better hightail it home, right? So Jacob makes mentions of this, particularly brings up the fact that God had delivered him from Esau. Jacob clearly knew the foreign gods in his house were not acceptable, but he had all, up to this point, allowed them. Hadn't he? Mm-hmm. Now, how long they had been there, we don't know. But at least they had been there as long as since they left Laban's house. We don't know if they didn't have some hanging around when he was living over there in Paddan Aram, but we know for sure Rachel stole some, and they left. And at some point, Jacob found out about it, or he wouldn't have had any reason to bring this up, right? He knew, in my house, there is the worship of other gods. And he allowed it. And it's not because he didn't know it wouldn't be pleasing to God, because if he didn't know it wouldn't be pleasing to God, why ask them to cough him up now? Just before he's going to meet with God again. You know, it kind of tells on you, right? Yes, Terry.
Thought I had a few minutes ago is that they probably brought even some more from the Shechem.
Oh, yeah. That's a good thought. You're right. They probably had some brand new shiny ones that they just pulled up from that city. Absolutely. That's a very good thought. You're right. Almost certainly, in fact. So, what's that?
Because they carried away the women and the children, and they would have probably brought their gods.
Brought their gods, too. Yeah. So, I mean, they're laden down with gods. There's no question. But up to this point, and that is a possibility. It's possible that maybe Jacob had gotten rid of the ones in his house, if he ever did find out about Rachel keeping them. I don't know if he ever found out or not. Maybe these were just the gods that his sons brought home. I don't know. That's a possibility I had not considered. So I'm glad you brought that up. But one way or the other, he said, get rid of them. Bring them to me. We're going to get rid of them, right? So, let's see. Jacob's mother's nurse had died and was buried beneath the timber tree So it was named Alon Bakuth, which is in her honor, which means the oak of weeping. God appears again to Jacob, at least we believe it was the second time now, that he had put Paddan Aram finally behind him, the land of Laban. God reminds him of his covenant name Israel. Jacob offers tithes in the form of cattle offerings. And then if you skip down to verse 14, Jacob also offers a tithe in the form of drink offerings. And at least we suppose that it was, this is where he was honoring what he promised God when he first left Bethel. And that was, of all the things that you give me, I will give a tenth, right? So it's very likely that that's what this was. Just outside of Bethlehem, Rachel dies in childbirth. She calls her son Ben-Oni, which means son of my sorrow. But Jacob more than likely could not bear the sorrow of his wife's sorrow for a lifetime in the name of her last gift to him. So he renames him Benjamin, son of my right hand, so as to hold her close to his heart through him. Because we can see that even though Joseph was Jacob's favorite, Benjamin was definitely second runner-up, without question. He held his boy in very high esteem. He was the darling of all the boys, especially after he thought that Joseph had died, which is in the future of our reading, right? So, he held his boy close to his heart. And he certainly wanted to have good remembrance of Rachel, not bad ones. So one way or the other, he renamed him to son of my right hand rather than son of my sorrow.
Mark,
yes,
Benjamin was younger than
Joseph. Yes, absolutely. Joseph had already been born. He was the last one born before this one. Yes, both of them being born from Rachel. So Reuben dishonors his father by having sex with one of his wives. Apparently, again, Jacob said nothing. If he said anything, we don't know it. It just says he knew it. You remember I told you way back in Genesis, the first three chapters, that all men are the offspring of our first father, Adam, who was there when his wife was being tempted and said nothing. It is a tendency inside of men to either say nothing or to only say something when they're angry enough. It's a tendency. It doesn't mean that all men are gridlocked to be that way, but it is a tendency we have to overcome, which is why God told Eve, you're going to want to rule the guy, but he has to rule over you. It's what's right. And why is she going to have a desire to rule over him? Because there's going to be a lot of times when it's going to seem like if I don't do something, nothing's going to happen. I mean, that happens to more women. It's not just you. Every woman, I think, most women on the planet have experienced this at some level, even if they got a great husband at some point
wrong.
Or another. What?
It's still wrong.
It's still wrong. No, there's no question. If he's going to supposed to take the lead, then he needs to be proactive. Part of the word provision means to see ahead, to go ahead and scout out the land and make preparations for the future. Provision doesn't just mean have a job. Yes.
So just kind of an analogy, if you're driving and the car's almost out of gas and the man driving won't get the gas,
mm-hmm.
The woman is to remain silent, let the man run out of gas.
It depends on your relationship.
Well, if he's your husband.
Well, it depends on the relationship you have with your husband. Terry could tell me, hey, honey, could you please get some gas because we're about to run out?
Yeah.
And Mark wouldn't be ticked off about that.
But if you refuse to do it.
Then, yeah, she needs to keep her hand off of it.
She needs to just sit there and.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Peter speaks to this very clearly. It says, wives must be submissive to their husbands in all things, just as the body of Christ is to the Lord. Well, that gives us a very clear comparison. In what way am I allowed to question the Lord's decisions?
Using her analogy of gas,
mm-hmm.
in the car,
mm-hmm.
they know that it needs to be put in there. They
mm-hmm.
don't put it in there.
Mm-hmm.
But you're the one that's going to have to be driving it around town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're supposed to let ourselves run out of gas.
No. No, we're not saying that. What you're saying is, if I understood what you're saying is, you got a husband and a wife in a car.
Yeah.
In the car together.
Yeah, together.
And you guys are about to run out of gas, let him run out of gas. If he parks it and the next person's got to drive it is you, the first place I drive it to is gas station. Mm. Now, if he tells you, I don't know if you want to put gas in this car again, then hire a cab or call a friend. You know, I mean, whatever he'll allow you to do. I mean, in most cases, unless you're just dealing with a very torrential person who's just being terribly unreasonable. I'm not just lazy. No, I'm talking about unreasonable. Who says, you know what? I don't ever want you to fill this car again. Don't ever let it be. I don't want you to ever pull it, period. Well, you know, now he's being unreasonable. Can that happen? Of course it can happen. It's probably happened thousands of times on the planet. But the bottom line is that, yes, obey the husband, period.
Unreasonable or not.
I'm sorry? Or unreasonable or not, yeah. I mean, we have to go back and allow the Bible to interpret itself. And Peter is very clear about this. He says, wives, be submissive to your husband in all things, even as the church is unto the Lord. Even as is a rather strong statement. Especially when you follow it up with the words, even as the church is to the Lord. Well, now I know to what degree I should be submissive. That means in all things, right? He didn't say church agree with the Lord. That would be wise, you know, on our half, because God's always right. Our husband isn't always right. You don't have to agree with him, but submit to him. Yeah, absolutely, without question.
Men don't always like to ask for directions, and Jacob's an example of
that. Yeah, I'm sure of that. I, on the other hand, have no problem asking examples for it. But it is, I agree, from what I understand, that is a traditional male thing. It's not, I know it's not true of all males, because I have no problem with it, but I think it is probably more true than not,
yeah, I mean,
for whatever reason.
If we want to draw just some parallels here and there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, we've all got our issues, and men are no exception. We've definitely got some major issues. So anyway, Reuben dishonors his father, and Jacob, as far as we can see, says nothing until later. Finally, Jacob finally visits his father before he dies at 180. Esau and Jacob no doubt have an interesting reunion as they commit their father to the ground. I say it's an interesting reunion because as best as we can tell, it doesn't look like Jacob ever actually went back and met Esau like he told he would. Well, you know, and so this is probably just an interesting get-together. I know I said I was going to meet you. Sorry about that. Let's go bury Dad. I don't know how that conversation went, but it probably wasn't a good one.
Do you think maybe Jacob sent word by someone to Esau?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like in that early world, somehow or another, there was some form of communication because we saw it earlier. Somehow Ishmael found out that Abraham had died. But we already know that he was dwelling in a much further land far away. And, you know, it's not like they had the telephone. So how did he find out? I don't know. But he found out, and so did Esau. Somehow they communicated it. So those are the things that I thought were the high points to draw out of that. Other than one other thing, and that is that I thought that was interesting. And that was that in that field where Jacob pitched his tent just beyond the Tower of Eber, there was a good land for pasture, which was just outside of what would many years later be called Bethlehem, is the exact same field, according to what historians believe, is the exact same field where the shepherds were keeping watch over their flock by night when they were told about Jesus' birth, just outside on the hills of Bethlehem. And it's interesting that it was in that same general location that Benjamin's name was turned from son of my sorrow to son of my right hand, which is another appellation of Jesus for the Father, that Jesus was the son of his right hand. So just an interesting little thing, whether by coincidence or whether by direction of the Lord, still pretty interesting. So any other thoughts? Yes.
Do you think the phrase that we hear probably not so much nowadays, as I was growing up, I think there's a lot of times, oh, he's my right-hand man.
Absolutely. Yeah, the history of that, the etymology of that phrase dates all the way back to here. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
One that you could trust and count on, and it would be there for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it meant it not only meant someone that you could rely upon, but also meant the expression of my strength. The Bible talked about the fact that when God desired, when the Father desired salvation for man, his own right hand brought salvation. Meant Jesus brought it for him. Right? Yes, uh-huh. Yes, sir.
Also, even the son of my sorrow is in a sense, could refer to Jesus.
Yes.
Sorrow of his loss and to come.
Yes, absolutely. So, so this parallelism all going on all over the place here. So, what are the thoughts you guys have? Any?
We didn't talk much about the trees there, particularly the one in Timbrinth and Shechem, where he buried the idols.
Yes.
That was definitely a place that Abraham had been involved with in previous chapters. Mm-hmm. And in one commentary I read, it said that it was often considered a holy place because it had been a place, I guess, where God had met with them at some point. So that could be a way in which he was sacrificing the idols to God there.
Mm-hmm.
But also one commentator said that it may have been a place because people looked at it as holy. They knew that nobody would go and disturb them there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it was a safe place to, quote, hide them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in case he might want to double back and pick them up later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. And also, one commentator may mention to another scripture that supposedly refers to that same tree as a tree of enchantments.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that there was more spiritual stuff going on there than...
Yeah. Yeah. So there may have been significance to that tree, without question. Yeah. I failed to bring that up.
It's interesting that they buried them rather than
destroying them. Yeah. And that may have been also a cultural thing. I don't know. I have no idea. But, I've thought the same thing. I'm thinking, why not just, burn them and melt them and destroy it? But, yeah. It always kind of struck me as, you stay right here and we may be back kind of thing. but that may not have been part of it at all. Yes, Doris.
Chapter 34, when Jacob was expressing his fear of all the people that could come after him now because of what his sons had done.
Yeah.
But then verse 5, chapter 35 says, and they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob.
Yeah.
And it's another example of God's protection.
Continue to protect him. Yeah.
Of course, it was the people that were, fearing God at that point, but Jacob was not. I don't know if he was even recognizing the fact, I'm stupid for being so fearful.
Mm-hmm.
My sons did the wrong. That's that's true. And it's possible that people would come, but my God will protect me if I do what he told me to do to begin with.
Yeah.
I can't make things right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, we've concluded the fact that it's entirely possible that that was one of the reasons why Jacob all of a sudden became eager to be obedient to go back, Now, again, the Lord had spoke to him as well. After this whole incident, it says the Lord spoke to him again and said, would you get home, please? Get home. And this time he obeyed. But I think that probably the time was right because of the very same situation you're bringing up. He had no incentive to stick around because he was afraid for his life. So I would agree with that. Yeah, huh?
One thing that I thought of when they said that the surrounding peoples did not pursue them.
Mm-hmm.
They heard what they did to
the Shechem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That town.
Mm-hmm.
What town was that?
It was the city of Shechem.
Oh, the city of Shechem.
The boy was named Shechem as well.
Yeah, okay. But so, it was by the fear of God.
Yeah.
They did not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're hearing these two guys wiped out this whole town.
Yeah. And there's still more boys at home.
Okay. So what is it? God's protection or the fear?
Well, God protected them, but it's very possible the way God protected them was to place their minds
using
that very thing. Yeah. The one thing that you notice throughout Scripture, if you pay attention, is that at least in most cases, I don't think that anybody can say it's an absolute, but in most cases, God doesn't do a miracle as he has to. If he can rely upon natural circumstances, the outflowing, the outcropping of reaping and sowing, he'll do it. If he has to intervene, a miracle, by definition, is a supernatural intervention of the natural course of nature. And God likes nature the way he set it up. And so he's going to avoid interrupting that every time he can, because he set it up that way for a reason, right? There are some times when it's necessary, and he has to step in and interpose a supernatural intervention on the natural course of things. But if he can allow the natural course to play out and it's still what he does what he wanted to do, I think that we see, it's my opinion, that's what I view when I'm looking at Scripture, I think what I often see is God allowing that to happen, you know? Or at least steering people's hearts to acknowledge or recognize what's happening. Like in this case, very likely he just reminded them pretty regular. You know, it was only two of them, and there's a lot more. And they killed a whole city, you know? And that's really, God wouldn't have to say that too much to make people afraid to go. Yeah. You know what I mean? So.
Better than building an electric fence.
Yes.
The sons waited 3 days before they even went to the city, because they knew that after the circumcision took place, these guys aren't going to feel like running out here fighting.
That's right.
and then the people that in the surrounding cities, whether they heard that or not, it didn't make any difference to them. Mm-hmm. Whether they were going by the fact that they took advantage of these people because that wasn't a key factor to them.
Clearly, yeah, because otherwise they would have thought, oh, well, we're not at a disadvantage, so we can overtake them. So, yeah. And you know, but I think it's also, it can't be sidestepped, the fact that by Jacob's own admission, in comparison just to the size of the city of Shechem, they were very few. Mm-hmm. He said so out of his mouth. He said, you know, and the Perizzites and the Canaanites are going to come and kill me because we're few in comparison to all these people, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they had wanted to, they could have taken it in their head to overtake them and thought, hey, you know, maybe the people of Shechem couldn't overtake them in a disadvantage, but three or four of our cities could easily overtake them. So it was probably a give and take of both. It was what had happened, plus the fact that God just imposed upon them that, you know what, yeah, don't do that. Things aren't going to work well for you if you do that. So any other thoughts? Yes, Terry?
Looking at the lineage, of course, I thought it was interesting to perceive. Relisted them once there was Benjamin to add to the list. But in looking at it, I know God foresaw that Judah would be the one from which Christ came.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, and of course he was called Praise. But it's interesting, not only in that, but because all the other ones, you know, it was the firstborn, the firstborn, the firstborn, except for, you know, Esau and Jacob. But it's like, obviously God saw it all ahead, but, you know, Reuben got disqualified because of his defilement.
Mm-hmm.
The next one was Simeon. He was part of the bloodshed.
Mm-hmm.
The next one was Levi. He was part of the bloodshed. So the next one in line is Judah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Absolutely. And so it was like God already knew that he was going to be the first one in line that would actually be able to carry on.
I agree. Yeah, there's a whole lot to Judah. So, to the point where they, you know, I mean, as you know, when the kingdom was divided, it was everybody else and Judah, you know. So, Judah was always different. There's no question. And they were always the better brother, even when they became a tribe. I mean, you'll see more than once in Scripture that says that the defilement of Israel was so bad that even Judah was taken away in their defilement. Even Judah. As if it would be, you know, you kind of expect it of the other guys, but even Judah, you know. So Judah seemed to always be, whether it was the man or the tribe, always seemed to be kind of like the better kids. It's also interesting, of course, Judah came out of the one that was unloved. So it's just all these things. There's so much to it, you know. You know, Isaiah says that when Jesus came, he was rejected by men and disdained, right? Very much like Leah felt. So he was a man acquainted with grief and sorrow, right? And we hid as if it were our faces from him. Jesus. Yeah.
When you said that, it's interesting because the incident with Reuben and Bilha happened right there where, outside of Bethlehem,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Where in the field. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where they set up camp. That's where it happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that is interesting. I wanted to ask, this is kind of off subject, but it says that they gave the foreign gods to Jacob, and they took the earrings
mm-hmm.
out of their ears. Was the symbolism of that was like slavery
no.
to the...
I don't think so. It's possible, but very unlikely. It clearly had a reference to their gods of some form. Whether or not, I doubt very seriously, had anything to do with the connection that Paul made, because he was making that up on the fly. It wasn't a thing, you know. In Paul's day, it was a real reality that you could become a bondservant, a natural bondservant to a natural person, and he just borrowed that and turned it into a Christian statement of becoming a bondservant to the Lord. But that was not, it wasn't a religious thing of being a bondservant to a god or something like that. It was just Paul was just being clever and using that terminology as an example.
So
that even though I've been set free by God, I choose to serve him because he loves me. So he called himself a bondservant. Go ahead.
Do you have any idea why they gave their earrings?
No, other than the fact that it clearly had a connection to their gods. Because the whole point was to get rid of your points of idol worship. So, but it doesn't choose to tell us how those earrings played into that. But, it wouldn't be the first time that some form of jewelry is connected with worship, so or dedication to a god of some sort. So,
like a pentagram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, any other thoughts? Let me show you this before we close. So you have a visual to go by. This isn't very big, I know, but I can point out to you on the map. Right over here is Paddan Aram, which is where he went to where Laban lived. Okay, he came from all the way down here, and I'll show that on the next one. In fact, I guess I'll just go ahead and go to the next. Go there. You got Beersheba, and then Bethel, and then Paddan Aram. You have some other stuff in between here, but I'll show you. But this is where the whole thing began, and left from Beersheba to go to Bethel, and then Bethel he went up to go to where Paddan Aram is, because that's where Laban was. On his way back, he went to Succoth, and then to Shechem, and then back down to Bethel. And that you can see on the next one, which is up here, of course, was Paddan Aram, and he went from there to Succoth, which is right here, and then from there he crossed the Jordan to Shechem, and then from Shechem he went straight from there down to Bethel, which is a very short distance, and then from Bethel down to just outside of Bethlehem, which is right here, and then from Bethlehem, of course, down here to Beersheba, which is where he was headed the whole time. Okay, so it's all in that area. So it was a good stint, an area that covers a lot of land, which this other picture makes it all the more clear because you're getting it on the globe. That's a big spot of land there,
yeah.
You know. So on the other pictures, it might look a little smaller, but when you have the globe, you can see, well, gee, that's a long area. Essentially traveled the greater portion of the vertical part of the United States to go from one end to the other. You know, he was traveling from the tip of Florida to the top of Maine or New York, to go from one end to the other, right? So it's a big area to cover. So I made several stops along the way. So as far as chapter 36, I'm not going to read it. I'm going to have you guys read it on your own. When we come back together to discuss chapter 37 and 38, I'm going to spend some time with 36 myself. I'm asking you to please read 36 anyway. But I'm going to spend some time with it and just see how much of the lineage of Edom, of Esau, which was Edom, becomes important later on in Scripture, so that I can bring it up and make some sense out of the chapter for you as to why God brought it up. It's entirely possible that the 36th chapter only exists for one purpose. It could be that most of these didn't show up at all in Israel's future. In fact, maybe not even the rest of the Bible. Some of them did. But it could be that most of them didn't. But God had that chapter written because, again, it gives attestation to the validity of Scripture, because times and dates and kings and names are all mentioned. And who was born by who. And certain times the wife and mother of are brought up specifically. And this allows us to tack down the Bible, which is makes it a unique book in comparison to most other ones. Because most other books are not real keen on being able to be tacked down to names and places and dates. The Bible intends to be understood as a literal book, which is why it gives you those things. And there has... I'm sorry?
And as time marches on, it's being proven more and more.
It's being proven more and more, absolutely. There are a number of places in the Bible that have fallen under scrutiny that have yet to be proven or disproven. But everything that so far, nothing has been categorically disproven in the Bible at all. One of the most classic examples of it is the city of David itself. Until our generation, they never found it. They didn't know it even existed. They believed, they came to believe it was a matter of folklore until they were actually, I don't even think it was an archaeological dig. I think that they were actually paving a road or creating a road from one place to the other. And in their, you know, clearing out the land, they ran into a gate that was buried, and the inscription on the gate was the city of David. But until our century, they couldn't find anything that proved that such a city ever even existed. The Bible talks about it a lot. And so people were willing to write it off, well, you can't trust the Bible. They've never even found one of the most important cities in the entire Old Testament, the city of David. One of the prominent figures in the whole Bible, you can't even find the city that was named after him. That's a bunch of hooey. In our century, they found it.
But they proved that David did live.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, without question.
For a long time, they hadn't, right?
I don't know about that, but I know for a fact there's a lot of attestation to the life and time of David. Even to the point that the History Channel did a whole spoof on David, and they tried to turn him into a bad guy, that they knew that he was a negative man, and he was a man of nothing but, you know, and he was a man of war, but they did the entire mock-up totally from the vantage point of him being a man of war, a dishonorable man, a man that did not keep his word and took advantages of other people, that kind of thing. They weren't during that broadcast, they weren't denying his existence. They were going out of their way to prove that he existed, but just from a negative standpoint. So no doubt they probably brought up the whole Bathsheba thing and having that man killed as well, which is something he did do. He did a lot of things that were bad. So, you know, but yeah, no, they know he existed without question. All right, we'll go ahead and close in prayer. And like I said, we'll pick up with chapter 17 and probably 18.
No,
we're not going to do 6 at 36. I'm sorry, 37 to 38 next time. Okay? All right.